Welcome to Get Real, talking mental health and disability. I'm Emily Webb. This episode is our 24th in our lived experience series, where we are speaking with some remarkable people who are sharing their stories in a way that might help other people in need of support. And a note before we start. The conversations on this podcast contain discussions of mental health, including trauma, post-traumatic stress, and suicide. If you have been affected by anything discussed in these episodes, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. The guest for this conversation is Will Patterson, a self-confessed Mr. Ordinary, but the experience you'll hear Will talk about is anything but. Will was a husband, dad, and corporate employee living in outer eastern Melbourne when his life started to unravel. On the outside, his life looked like the suburban dream, but things were not well, and he ended up going to jail. Will wrote a memoir, Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail, about his experience, and as you'll hear him share, his whole outlook on life has changed. Hello, Will. It's so great to have you join us on Get Real.
Hey, Emily. Thanks heaps for the invite. I'm very happy to be chatting.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've last spoken, but you wrote a memoir called Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail about your experience going to prison. It was for fraud. I'll disclose to listeners before we start that we've met before because you first came on Australian True Crime Podcast, which I co-host, and it was actually that interview that led to a publisher contacting you to write the book.
Yeah, it was quite incredible, actually. I think when I think about it now, I seem to remember you guys on the podcast said, if you know anybody or if you've got any interesting stories, contact us. And I just went, oh, yeah, not thinking that the way the email would read to you was, hi, I'm a criminal and I'd like to come to your studio and talk to you on a Saturday. So it must have been a little bit of a leap of faith. Yeah, I wrote a diary while I was in jail, and that diary became the spine of the book. So for me, even that tiny little bit at the start, like one of the big things I've learned is since I accepted the punishment and admitted my mistakes about the fraud, all I have received from the world is kindness in ways that I had no right to expect.
And now we've got you on Get Real podcast. Yeah. Really excited about that. And I was really keen to catch up with you again because, you know, a few years have passed since you wrote the book Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail and since you did your time in jail. And a lot's happened for you in terms of readjusting to life, creating a new future for yourself. And for listeners who may not have read the book, tell us about what life was like for you before you went to jail, the Mr. Ordinary that you describe yourself as.
Yeah, for sure. It was actually Australian True Crime that came up with the name Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail. That was the name of the episode. Extremely accurate, though. So, look, I was just a suburban dad. I've got one child. I was mostly happily married, like most people are. We had our troubles. I worked at an insurance company and life was pretty simple like that. We received an inheritance and we decided with that we would buy a little beach house and we'd do some renovation work at home. And just slowly over time, debt started to pile up. So we had debt with the mortgage. Having a beach shack is expensive because you've got to pay two lots of rates, et cetera, et cetera. The reno started building up. The credit cards started building up. And we just got more and more into financial pressure, which can be really debilitating, I think. Like if you're the person in the relationship that looks after the money and you're constantly worried that how am I going to pay the next bill, is our income enough to cover all of this, it just becomes a pressure in your relationship that impacts every part of the relationship. So I don't think I was different to anybody else, any other suburban family in Australia. I think, you know, we're incredibly fortunate in Australia. We're an affluent country, but we all have these sort of troubles. I think people could connect with, you know, marriage isn't perfect. Financial puts more pressure on that. Mental health struggles for myself, which I'm sure we'll get into shortly. All of those things are very ordinary. So I think that the mistakes I made could have potentially happened to anyone.
And so on Get Real, we talk to people about their mental health. And you talk openly about your mental health in the lead up to the crimes that you were committing and the circumstances. And can you tell us about what was happening for you at this time? I mean, you explained that you were sort of getting rising debt, but what was your understanding about the mental health aspect of what was going on for you?
I think that a lot of the things that I have problems with, which are around the anxiety and depression, have probably been part of my life for a long time when I look back. But dealing with those things, that journey really started for me in 2005 when my son was born. As soon as I held him, I got anxious and it didn't go away. And then I would get really depressed. Like, my brain is not a team player. My brain is not on team Will. I'm not sure what team it's on, but it's not on team Will. My brain is a very negative little beast, and I have a lot of negative self-talk that goes on in my head. As soon as he was born, I started getting, I don't deserve this happiness. I don't deserve this baby. I'm going to mess this baby's life up. What did I do to deserve this? This is terrible. You know, I had a mirror on my bedside table, which when I woke up in the night, which is four or five times a night, I would go in and make sure he was still breathing. I just put the mirror under his nose because I was smart enough to know you don't wake up a sleeping baby. But I had to check that he was still alive. And I went to see my doctor in 2005 for a flu shot. And he said to me, "So how are you, Will?" I'm like, "Good." He's like, "That's good. That's great. So actually, how are you?" I'm like, "No, I'm good. I'm good." And then the third time he said, "But how are you?" And it all came out. I'm not sleeping. I feel anxious all the time about the baby. I get depressed because I don't deserve him. I'm going to mess him up. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. And that started a long journey with my doctor, with a cognitive behavior therapist, and with medication. And one of the things I learned was anxiety and depression can be chemical, and they can also be emotional. So at the start, I didn't want to take medication. I thought that's not for me. But long conversations with my therapist about if we can control the chemical, then you can learn to control the emotional, was super important for me. So all of that was happening from 2005. And then, you know, you pile all the other stuff that we've just spoken about on top of that, and you end up in a bit of a mess.
Yeah, I definitely relate to what you said about the when you have a newborn and just that checking all the time. I can remember doing that and just being completely terrified. I recall that in your memoir and when we've spoken before, that you said that you were in a way relieved when you got found out by the organisation you were working for the offences you were committing. You were like taking money basically because the pressure and torment of what you were doing was just unsustainable. Can you talk about that? Because some people might think, well, God, you'd hope that you wouldn't get caught. But for you, that was a bit of a different experience.
And it's kind of you to say it took some money. It was about $300,000 over 18 months. So it was I'd seen people like that on the news before and gone, why would you be so stupid as to risk your job to just for that amount of money? And yet here I am. I was completely relieved when I got caught because at first I did it out of what I think was necessity because we would have lost the house, et cetera, et cetera. And then it became greed. And then I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong the whole time I was doing it, but I got to the point where I didn't know how to stop. So at first I needed it and then I wanted it and then I knew I wanted it to stop, but then I didn't know how to make it stop. And the only way it was ever going to stop was for me to get caught. And so when I walked into that room and the forensic people said, "We've got some things we need to talk to you about. We've got some transactions we want to question you about." I said, "I did it. Whatever it is you think I did it." And I was so relieved because I knew it could stop then. And the trickiest thing for me with that was it made me look uncaring to people. You know, there's that grief journey that people talk about that, you know, there's anger and there's denial and there's acceptance and all those sort of steps. I was at acceptance because I knew everything that I'd done and I was relieved because it could stop. But all of the people that loved me in my life were at the start of that journey. And so when they'd get mad or upset and I was calm, they'd think I didn't care. You know, I remember my best friend, Dan, saying to me, "We are only still friends because you accepted what you did wrong." And I could see that you were relieved, but I could also see that you weren't going to fight it. You were going to stand up and say, "I did it." And that's the only reason why we're still mates. So,
one of the most powerful parts of your memoir, Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail, is your description of your first night in jail. And I remember, you know, hearing that for the first time when I chatted to you quite a few years ago now. Would you share with listeners some of that chapter? Because it's seared in my memory and it was very powerful.
Yeah, I sure will. No problem. So the first thing that happens to you as a prisoner is tea. I'm escorted to the holding cells by two police. I'm fairly sure, for me at least, they are there to make sure I don't faint rather than to make sure I don't cause any trouble. After handing over my belt and shoes, I'm put into a cell that has perspex walls all alone. A kind-faced lady, one of the officers, asks if I know where I am. When I answer that I do, she hands me a cup of hot, very milky, very sweet tea. It warms me up and restores my blood sugar, which is, I suspect, its intended effect. In this clear-walled cell for about an hour, I mostly sleep. I find out later that it's an observation unit. All prisoners spend time in here, so the officers can make sure you don't hurt yourself from the shock. It is also where the prison system decides if you are innocent or guilty. The innocent ones are the ones in danger. They pace, they cry, they rant, they beg for phone calls. The guilty, we sleep. Eventually, after many hours, they wake me and I'm moved to the Melbourne Assessment Prison, the MAP. Once I'm put in the MAP, I'm in line after line and cell after cell. It feels like a very long time, but in truth, it's only about an hour. I move through four cells, each filled with men whose faces range in expression from resignation to terror. I feel a lot closer to terror, but I try and keep my face as neutral as possible. Every doctor and contract worker and officer I speak to, and there are nine in all, want me to ask this, answer the same questions. Do you know why you're here? Do you know where you are? Have you had any thoughts of self-harm? By the fourth interview, it just feels like a process, and I'm not convinced anyone actually cares about my state of mind or my risk of self-harm. One doctor finally says to me, "Are you taking any medication?" This is a question I'm prepared for, and I direct him to the letter from my doctor that outlines my various ailments and remedies. The prison doctor reviews all of the work that Dr. Brian and I have done over the last 4 years with yes, yes, no, definitely not, sure, but I don't know why, and oh no, I was surprised you're ever given that, so no. Four out of the seven medications I take are approved. Not a bad effort, I suppose. It's going to take 5 weeks to have the rest of them approved. Finally, with arms full of prison-issue blankets, I'm escorted in the dark up various flights of stairs, across a shadowy and alien courtyard and into my unit. The cell is unlocked and I'm introduced to my cellmate. Showing me the panic button, the officer explains that I should press it if I feel like I might hurt myself or if I have any concerns that anyone else might hurt me. Looking my cellmate up and down, I think of the condoms I've been issued in my bag. Older than me, mid-50s, I guess, he looks about as confident as I feel, and I judge it unlikely I'll receive any advances that night, which is just as well because the panic button is next to the bottom bunk right beside his pillow. I would have to be very close to him indeed if I was panicking. The officer locks us up, and I wonder how I will sleep without my nighttime tablet Seroquel. The answer is terribly. I have a panic attack a few hours in. Unable to go outside, I can barely even see outside through the cracked perspex covering our window. Realising this is my life for the next 9 months, my chest tightens and anxiety takes its familiar grip. I cry as quietly as I can and my cellmate pretends not to hear me. At one point, I get up to use the toilet and he smiles, wordlessly offering me a Tim Tam on my way back to my bunk. I accept gratefully. I crawl back into my bed and I cry until I source myself and finally fall asleep.
Yeah, it's the Tim Tams that really got me when I heard you tell that story. And, you know, you met some really interesting people in jail. I mean, you're interacting with, you know, people that you wouldn't ordinarily interact with. And, you know, you went into the jail system as a man, you know, a professional, you're educated. But a lot of the men you spent time with had literacy issues, lots of mental health stuff. And you do talk about the relationships you formed. I want to find out from you about some of the ways that your life was changed from the men that you met in prison.
Yep. That the Tim Tam, you know, that was one of the first moments of kindness that I had no right to expect, you know, and that's what's built on my life from that moment that I went, I did this, you know, I look back and I think there's so many of those sort of occasions, One of the biggest things I learned that changed my perspective on life is everybody is just a person trying to survive. When I was at the MAP, the first day I was at that prison, my cellmate said to me, "Don't make eye contact with the crazy Aboriginal guy in the yard." He bit the ear off the last guy that made eye contact with him. And immediately fear, oh, my God, I'm in prison. All I've done to train myself for being ready in prison is watch helpful shows like Orange is the New Black and Prisoner, not helpful at all. You go for a walk around this tiny little yard, and the first day I went for a walk around the yard, I made eye contact with this guy, and he just smiled and nodded at me. And so then the next time I went for a lap, he just smiled and nodded at me. And so after about the fifth time, I walked over to him, and I put my hand out and said, Will, and he said, Benny. And that was all we did. We didn't have more of an interaction than that. And then 3 or 4 days later, it was pouring rain, and I was sitting in the unit playing chess with someone, and I felt a guy standing behind me, and I heard Benny say no. So I looked up and said to him, well, what would you do? And he moved, and he got the guy I was playing to checkmate in 4 moves. He was brilliant. He was just seriously troubled, but he was just a guy trying to survive, you know. And there was another occasion up at the prison I spent most of my time at in Beechworth. I worked in the kitchen, and there was a guy I worked in the kitchen with who was openly gay. He was a bit like me. He was an idiot. He got caught holding all the drugs for his mates at a dance party, and he went to prison because he had a commercial amount of drugs on him, you know. And he came down to our unit one day in tears and started telling us all the things that were happening to him in his unit, so that the other people in his unit would do things like, once he had had a shower, they would make him wash the gay off the shower before they used the shower so that they didn't catch it. And they'd do just like awful, awful things to him. And he just had got to the point where he couldn't cope with it anymore and needed to talk to somebody, because he was just a human being after all. And him and one of my mates, Fluoro, and myself had a chat with him, and we made a decision that I would go and ask the prison officers if he and I could swap cells. So I would go and live in this unit where the people were being cruel to him, and he would come to our unit where he was safe. You know, and that sort of stuff, that everybody's just a person trying their best to survive. And the best you can do for them is just accept them in the way that they're coming to you. That was a really, really big lesson for me. And then the other huge lesson that I learned in prison, there's this expression in prison, which is do your own time. Now, in jail, that means a particular thing. What it means is don't get involved in other people's messes. Don't let other people get involved in your messes. You decide the way you want to do your time. You do your time and you go home. But what I've found is that is such a lesson that I can take into the rest of my life. Do your own time. You know, I think maybe a way that a lot of people could think about that is, you know, look at Instagram, right? You've got so many friends on Instagram that have got a perfect Instagram life, but that's not the way I choose to do my time. If I'm having a hard day and I want to post something on Instagram, I'll put something on the Instagram that says, hey, everybody, I'm fucking struggling. You know, and if I've got a group of mates that if I text one of them and go, I need you, I know that they'll ring me within 2 minutes, and I'll do the same for them. But I've made that decision because that's how I want to do my time, you know. And those are probably the two biggest lessons I learned in prison.
Yeah, it's so helpful to hear insights from people who have actually got that lived experience, because, you know, yes, we watch television shows and, as you say, not helpful, particularly not for you when you're preparing. But yeah, it's just so valuable to hear your experience. And another experience I want to talk about is what it's like to be a parent in jail, because we know people in jail are parents, especially women. Obviously, you know, men are parents too. And we've spoken a bit about your son, and he was in primary school when you went to jail.
Yep.
And, you know, I've met him, and you've got a beautiful relationship. Can you talk about what that experience was like and how you maintain that connection and how you got used to things when you were out of jail with parenting? Because, you know, it would have been quite confusing for him and also for you.
My ex-wife said to me, his mum said to me, I don't want to tell him when you are. I want to tell him that you're going to Western Australia to work in the mines and you'll be back in 9 months. And I said, all right, okay, no worries, and completely ignored her and told him the truth. Because I knew that if I didn't do that, he wouldn't be able to visit, I wouldn't be able to talk to him on the phone, it would just be so hard. And I also went to his school and I talked to the principal and a couple of staff members. I talked to like his footy coach and a couple of people. So they knew what was happening, so he had some support around him. Once she knew that I had done that, she was actually incredibly supportive, because she drove from Melbourne to Beechworth every second weekend so that he could visit me. and spend time with me. I'd talk to him every day on the phone. It was hard. And funnily enough, like, you'd think I was there over his birthday, over Christmas. You would think those were the hardest days, and they weren't. The absolute hardest days for me were the days he was distracted, because he was 10. So I'd ring some nights and he'd got a new game, or there was a day when he had just got his puppy and he didn't want to talk to me. And it wasn't cruelty, although that's what the voice in my head would tell me. You know, my negative self-talk would say, well, of course he doesn't want to talk to you. You're a piece of shit. You're a criminal. You're in jail. You're not impacting his life. But it wasn't the truth. He was just distracted because he was 10. But those days were the hardest days for me while I was inside. And when I came home, it was a lot harder for me than it was for him. So we had a conversation one day where I had my own unit, my own apartment, and he said to me, you know, when are you going to come home? And I had to have that conversation to say, I don't think I am going to come home. I don't think Mum wants me to come home. I knew Mum didn't want me to come home. But this is going to be, this is how our life is going to be. This is what our family is going to be like now. And he sort of just stopped and looked at me for a minute. I thought he was going to cry. And then he goes, so can I have a lizard? And so, kids are astonishingly resilient. But it was a lot harder for me, because for a very long time, I felt like I owed him everything that I thought I had missed while I was inside, which meant that I gave in to him and I spoiled him more than I should and I protected him more than I should. Now, when I met the lady who I'm married to now, Christina, I kept her and CJ apart for too long. So, I didn't want him to be, I didn't want him to be, see a rotating turnstile of women coming in and out of my life as if I could actually achieve that. But I wanted to protect him from those early stages of a relationship. I wanted to make sure the relationship would be a real thing before he met somebody. But I left it too long, and it impacted their relationship for a while, because it meant that Christina felt like I would always prioritise him over her, that it wasn't an even thing. And he came to me one day and he said, why are there gold hoop earrings on your bedside table, Dad? Right? And I said to him, I panicked. I'm like, we had a dress-up day at work and I went as a pirate. He said to me since, he goes, I knew that was bullshit, Dad. I just decided not to call you on it. So it's taken me a long time to get my head right about my relationship with CJ since I came home. But he's been a lot more resilient than I have.
Thanks for sharing that, because it's difficult to, talk about these things and be really raw about the experience of, when something not great's happened and got to try and fix it. And I think that's what we love doing on this podcast, talking about things that could be really helpful. Have you kept any contact with anyone you were in prison with?
One person. Yeah. I had contact with two when I came home, and one of them don't know what's happened to him. The other person I've kept contact with was that gay guy I was telling you about before. And he's gone on to have quite a wonderful life. We're Facebook mates because he doesn't live in Australia anymore. So, it's the only way to stay in contact. But we'll chat every now and again. And the last interaction I had with him was that his sister works in Melbourne and she is an aged care support person, goes and visits people's homes. And one of her clients had passed away. She wasn't sure what to do. And I work in the funeral industry now. And he actually contacted me and said, do you think you can help? So I did. So, yeah, he's the only person, though.
Well, let's talk life after jail, because you had to exit it after 9 months. And as you said, a lot had happened and quite an intense experience being in jail. But you have had some really great support with people to help you. And look, that is certainly not the experience for a number of people exiting the correction system. But can you talk a bit about what it's been like readjusting and how you've changed your life?
So when I first came home, like 2 days after I got home, CJ, my son, wanted to go and have yamcha. So we went and had yamcha and I had a panic attack because there's too many people, too much noise, too many people moving around me. And those sort of things kept happening on and off. For the first couple of weeks. And I went to see my therapist and she said, oh, yeah, that's just PTSD. And I said, no, it's not. It's not that, because that's what soldiers get and that's what firemen get and that's what the people who ran towards the collapsing towers on 9/11 get. you know, it's all I've done is go to jail. Don't give me that. And she said, okay, well, you've had a trauma, and post that trauma, you're getting stress. So what would you like me to call it? Because it's PTSD. That's the term we use for what you're experiencing. Just because you've got it doesn't mean somebody else doesn't have it bad or different. But it's reality. It's what you've got. If you want me to deal with it, you have to accept that that's the term that we're going to use, which was a bit of a revelation to me, because I just felt like, okay, I'm allowed to own that term, and it doesn't diminish anybody else who's got what I would call real PTSD, because it's just what it is. And accepting that that's part of the journey and dealing with that is, you know, that was a big step, big first step for me. Finding a job was super hard, Emily. It was so much harder than it should be. And I was determined to be honest. So I got and lost 3 jobs at the last hurdle, because they would say to me, is there anything else you need to tell us, or we're going to do a police check? And I'd be honest and say, well, there's something you're going to find. I remember going for a job at a car dealer. The guy said, is there anything else you want to tell me? And I said, yep, I need to tell you this. I've come home from prison recently. It was a fraud. It was this and this. And he got so angry at me. Why haven't you told me this? And I said, oh, this is my first opportunity. I'm telling you at the first opportunity. He got so mad that he stormed out of his office, stormed out of the dealership and left. And I sat in his office for about 10 minutes and went, I guess I probably should go home then. Like, don't know what to do. And so, and my dad said to me, will you, dickhead? You can't just tell people that, because they won't give you a chance, because all you're telling them is you're a con. And people aren't going to take a chance on a con. So find a business. The next person that doesn't ask you, don't tell them. Don't wait any longer than a month, and tell them after a month when you've proved that you're a decent human being. And that's what I did with this company that I work for now. I worked for them for about a month. I went to the boss and said, I have to tell you something, and told him all about jail. I gave him the whole truth. And he said, that's a lot. You'll have to leave it with me. So I went and I packed up my desk. He said, come back to me at 3 o'clock, and I packed up my desk. I was ready to go. And I walked into his office and he said, this was a mistake in your past, wasn't it? And I said, yes. And he said, that's where we're going to leave it. Go back to your desk and get on with work. It was astonishing. Like, talk about the grace and the kindness that you've got no right to expect, you know. And I'm still with that company. And it's not because I feel obligated to them because they gave me a chance. It's because they're an excellent company to work for. And I have a career with them. And I have a company credit card, and I sign checks for them, and, you know, they put their money where their mouth is. But there is one thing I just want to tell you about Christina, who's now my wife. About 6 months into our relationship, I had a complete breakdown. We had a dumb little argument about something, and I can't even remember what that argument was about. I think it was about a page that I followed on Instagram and she didn't like it, or something stupid like that. And I broke up with her. I, this is rubbish. You're terrible for me. You're trying to control me. All this stuff just spewed out of me, just hate and darkness and yuck. And I will never, ever forget what she said to me, because she was at my house. She said, if you want to break up with me, that's okay. I can survive you, Will. Sorry. But it sounds like you're in pain, and I don't want to leave you here in pain. So what I want to do is just talk to you until I feel like you're safe, and then I'll go. Mm. And it was almost 24 hours of just me. And what it was I hated me. And I just let the hate in my head build up. And I believed that I didn't deserve what I was finding with her. And it changed our whole relationship. It made us the people we are today, you know. And the thing I learned out of it was the fear of the secret that you hold inside is always worse than the secret itself. Always. Whether it was me stealing money and then admitting it, or whether it was me not telling her about my mental health issues and letting it build up in my head to the point where I felt like the only thing I could do was break up with her. The secret is always worse than the truth.
Mm, wow. Thank you for sharing that. It's, you know, I'm thinking about, you did your jail time. That's your punishment in the eyes of the law. And did you feel like you still had to keep making amends? Because, you know, what I find in society now is, you know, there is that notion of forgiveness and amends, but it just feels like life is really intense with, you know, people never being able to move past the mistakes they've made. And I feel like that is due to the fast pace of social media, things like that. And it does worry me. It feels like it's hard to sort of make mistakes and be okay in this life at the moment. What do you think about that?
Andrew Denton. I was listening to a podcast with him, and he used a term which was outrage archaeology. That people are just so committed to digging through your past until they find something they can be outraged about. The thing that combats that is that I'm just open about it. It's not a secret. So if a new person starts at work and then I hear them whispering, I go, come in the office. I've heard that you're asking this question. Let's talk about it. You know, yes, I've been to prison. Yes, this is what happened. You know, yes, I own it. And it negates outrage archaeology, because no one can cancel you if you already own it. When I came home, there were people that felt like I needed to make amends, and there was people that I had a rocky relationship with because they didn't think I'd made amends. But what I do in terms of making amends is I just live my life like I've been given a second chance. You know, I treat theft like people treat alcoholism, or like, you know, I think I've got a bit of an addictive personality, and I think I got a bit addicted to the theft. So like an alcoholic says, I'm an alcoholic, but every day I choose not to drink, I say I'm a thief, and every day I choose not to be a thief.
It's like gambling and stuff, isn't it? It's that compulsiveness and having to abstain from it. And curiously, I know we had a few people ask when you appeared on Australian True Crime, did you have to pay the money back? Like, how was that all sorted out?
You know, like I've done a few talks, and off the back of the memoir, and there's always two questions. Did you have to pay the money back, and how could your wife not have known? They're the two questions I get, right? So did you have to pay the money back? This is the astonishing thing about that. The company that I worked for needed me to go to court and get convicted, because then they could claim on their insurance, because big insurance companies have insurance for things like fraud. So once they got paid, they didn't care. The company who insured them for fraud is a massive Singapore-based international reinsurance company. And what my solicitor told me was their process is, if the recovery is less than $1 million, it's not worth recovering. And so I've never had any contact. Before I went to prison, I made as much reparations as I could. So when CJ's mum and I separated financially, I gave the majority of that money to the court to give back. And that probably reduced my sentence. It put me in a much worse financial situation than when I got home, but it probably reduced my sentence from 2 years to 9 months. But I've never been contacted and asked to. And in my head, I was always of the opinion, if you go to prison, that's the reparations. And if you don't go to prison, you're going to need to work on paying it back. Yeah, so that's the big thing. And just to answer the other question that you didn't ask about, how could your wife possibly not know? I think willful ignorance is what that was. As long as our bills were being paid, she didn't care.
I think willful ignorance is something that we all exercise in different areas of life, isn't it? Just depending on what's happening. Will, as we wind up, what does good mental health look like for you today?
The biggest thing for me is uncomfortable conversations. I lost a mate about 18 months ago who suicided. And none of us were expecting it. None of us knew it was going to happen. A couple of his mates, closer mates than me, knew that he wasn't happy. But he didn't talk about it, and he didn't reach out. And that's what I did when I was stealing as well. If I had reached out to Dan, it would have stopped. He would have made it stop. But I didn't reach out because it was a terrible secret. So uncomfortable conversations for me are so important. And I remember having a conversation with Dan after our friend suicided, and we were both just checking in on each other. And I find with the male friends in my life, those are the moments where we tell each other we love each other. You know, men don't do that often enough. But I did say to him, you don't have to worry about me. I'm dramatic. So if I've had a bad day, I'll contact you. The one you've got to worry about is the one that doesn't. And so uncomfortable conversations for me are important, because it means that I'm facing the stuff that's in my head. I try and have uncomfortable conversations with my mates too. So like on RUAK Day last year, I just picked four of my friends on Facebook that I hadn't talked to for a while, and I messaged all of them and said, I shouldn't have to wait till RUAK Day to do this, but I'm texting you today. And all four of them, all of them came back and said they were struggling. all of them. And so since that's happened, I have ongoing conversations with all four of them because they're all struggling. You know, and so good mental health for me is just, how do I say it? The demon in your head has got much less power if you name it and you talk about it and you shame it and you acknowledge it. It loses its power. And so that's a really important thing for me. And the other thing is this group of mates that I've got, like I said to you before, if I text them, I need you, they'll ring me in less than 5 minutes. And if I get that from any of them, that's our safe word, I guess. I need you. And that means this is no bullshit. This is, I'm not ringing to see if you want to go and see a Marvel movie. I need you. And so drop everything and ring me. And that happens. You know, I've walked out of meetings. I've had friends walk out of meetings. You know, it's just the way it is.
And with managing your mental health, you've mentioned that it's a combination of medication, life skill kind of things. Do you still see like professionals as well?
I do. I do still see my therapist, not as often. I had a hilarious thing happen in 2020 where I was getting really sick in the tummy and it was lasting for a while. So I ended up going to see my doctor and he said to me, I've got two options for you. The first one is break up with Christina. I'm like, what? And he goes, well, that's the first one because what's happening is your life is a lot happier now than it was when you came home from prison and you're taking too much Lexapro. It's if you take too much of it and you don't need it in your system, is it upsets your tummy? That's one of the knock-on effects. So he said, if you don't want to break up with Christina, just halve your tablet. It's the other option. But I thought I'd give you both options and I don't need as much of the therapy because I'm not, you know, the whole time I was with my therapist and that whole time I was stealing, I was seeing my therapist. How could she have possibly done a good enough job when I wasn't telling her the truth? Yeah, and now the truth's out there in every aspect of my life. I find I don't need it as often.
Yeah, well, you've certainly shown that, you know, telling your story is really powerful and we've spoken to other guests on this podcast about that. Any final thoughts before we wrap up for listeners? And I will put details in the show notes about where to get your book.
That'd be awesome. Thank you. One big mistake doesn't have to define your life. That's a massive thing I've learned. Going to prison is just a thing that happened in my past now. My life has moved forward. And the truth is I'm really grateful that I went to jail. I deserved it, but I needed it. And it was the pause in my life that I needed to redefine the way I wanted to live and to move past that mistake. And if you have one big mistake in your life, you know, you can choose to be a victim of that or you can choose to be a survivor of it. I'm a survivor.
Amazing, Will. A pretty dramatic pause, I'll say, in your life. But it often that's what it takes, isn't it? A really dramatic kind of rock bottom or incident that forces us to look at ourselves. I just want to say thank you so much for this conversation. I love talking to you and I think our listeners are going to really love hearing from you. So thank you for being a guest.
Oh, you're very welcome, Emily. You're really welcome. And I have had a couple of people when I first started talking about this contact me through the Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail page on Instagram or Facebook. And if people want to reach out, I'll chat. I won't probably ring you, but I'll chat, you know, because I think the more of us that are talking to each other about mental health, the safer we're all going to be. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk.
Thanks to our guest, Will Patterson. Will's memoir is called Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail, and he's on Instagram and Facebook. We've put the details for all these in the show notes for this episode. If you have been affected by anything discussed in this episode, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. And there's also 13 Yarn, which is 24/7 crisis support for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. I'm Emily Webb, and you've been listening to Get Real, talking mental health and disability. Join us next time on Get Real for more conversations about mental health. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love you to share Get Real with your friends and networks. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and look after yourself.